Today we'll be continuing The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Chapter 8, Part 2. Up in the city, I tried for a while to list the quotations on an interminable amount of stock. Then I fell asleep in my swivel chair. Just before noon, the phone woke me, and I started up with sweat breaking out on my forehead. It was Jordan Baker. She often called me up at this hour because the uncertainty of her own movements between hotels and clubs and private houses made her hard to find in any other way. Usually, her voice came over the wire as something fresh and cool, as if a divot from a green golf links had come sailing in at the office window. But this morning, it seemed harsh and dry. "I've left Daisy's house," she said. "I'm at Hempstead, and I'm going down to Southampton this afternoon." Probably it had been tactful to leave Daisy's house, but the act annoyed me, and her next remark made me rigid. "You weren't so nice to me last night." "How could it have mattered then?" Silence for a moment. Then, "However, I want to see you. I want to see you too. Suppose I don't go to Southampton and come into town this afternoon." "No, I don't think this afternoon." "Very well. It's impossible this afternoon. Various..." We talked like that for a while, and then abruptly we weren't talking any longer. I don't know which of us hung up with a sharp click, but I know I didn't care. I couldn't have talked to her across a tea table that day if I never talked to her again in this world. I called Gatsby's house a few minutes later, but the line was busy. I tried four times. Finally, an exasperated central told me the wire was being kept open for long distance from Detroit. Taking out my timetable, I drew a small circle around the 3:50 train. Then I leaned back in my chair and tried to think. It was just noon. When I passed the ash heaps on the train that morning, I had crossed deliberately to the other side of the car. I supposed there'd be a curious crowd around there all day, with little boys searching for dark spots in the dust, and some garrulous man telling over and over what had happened, until it became less and less real even to him, and he could tell it no longer. And Myrtle Wilson's tragic achievement was forgotten. Now I want to go back a little and tell what happened at the garage after we left there the night before. They had difficulty in locating the sister, Catherine. She must have broken her rule against drinking that night, for when she arrived, she was stupid with liquor and unable to understand that the ambulance had already gone to Flushing. When they convinced her of this, she immediately fainted, as if that was the intolerable part of the affair. Someone, kind or curious, took her in his car and drove her in the wake of her sister's body. Until long after midnight, a changing crowd lapped up against the front of the garage, while George Wilson rocked himself back and forth on the couch inside. For a while, the door of the office was open, and everyone who came into the garage glanced irresistibly through it. Finally, someone said it was a shame and closed the door. Michaelis and several other men were with him. First, four or five men. Later, two or three men. Still later, Michaelis had asked the last stranger to wait there 15 minutes longer, while he went back to his own place and made a pot of coffee. After that, he stayed there alone with Wilson until dawn. About 3 o'clock, the quality of Wilson's incoherent muttering changed. He grew quieter and began to talk about the yellow car. He announced that he had a way of finding out whom the yellow car belonged to, and then he blurted out that a couple of months ago his wife had come from the city with her face bruised and her nose swollen. But when he heard himself say this, he flinched and began to cry, "Oh my God," again in his groaning voice. Michaelis made a clumsy attempt to distract him. "How long have you been married, George? Come on there, try and sit still a minute and answer my question. How long have you been married?"
12 years.
"Ever had any children? Come on, George, sit still. I asked you a question. Did you ever have any children?"
The hard brown beetles kept thudding against the dull light. And whenever Michaelis heard a car go tearing along the road outside, it sounded to him like the car that hadn't stopped a few hours before. He didn't like to go into the garage because the workbench was stained where the body had been lying, so he moved uncomfortably around the office. He knew every object in it before morning, and from time to time sat down beside Wilson, trying to keep him more quiet.
"Have you got a church you go to sometimes, George?"
Maybe even if you haven't been there for a long time. Maybe I could call up the church and get a priest to come over and he could talk to you, see? Don't belong to any. You ought to have a church, George, for times like this. You must have gone to church once. Didn't you get married in a church? Listen, George, listen to me. Didn't you get married in a church? That was a long time ago. The effort of answering broke the rhythm of his rocking. For a moment, he was silent. Then the same half-knowing, half-bewildered look came back into his faded eyes. Look in the drawer there, he said, pointing at the desk. Which drawer? That drawer. That one. McKellis opened the drawer nearest his hand. There was nothing in it but a small, expensive dog leash made of leather and braided silver. It was apparently new. This? He inquired, holding it up. Wilson stared and nodded. I found it yesterday afternoon. She tried to tell me about it, but I knew it was something funny. You mean your wife bought it? She had it wrapped in tissue paper on her bureau. McKellis didn't see anything odd in that, and he gave Wilson a dozen reasons why his wife might have bought the dog leash. But conceivably, Wilson had heard some of these same explanations before, from Myrtle, because he began saying, "Oh my God," again in a whisper. His comforter left several explanations in the air. Then he killed her, said Wilson. His mouth dropped open suddenly. Who did? I have a way of finding out. You're morbid, George, said his friend. This has been a strain to you, and you don't know what you're saying. You'd better try and sit quiet till morning. He murdered her. It was an accident, George. Wilson shook his head. His eyes narrowed and his mouth widened slightly with the ghost of a superior. I know, he said definitely. I'm one of these trusting fellas, and I don't think any harm to nobody. But when I get to know a thing, I know it. It was the man in that car. She ran out to speak to him, and he wouldn't stop. McKellis had seen this too, but it hadn't occurred to him that there was any special significance in it. He believed that Mrs. Wilson had been running away from her husband, rather than trying to stop any particular car. How could she have been like that? She is a deep one, said Wilson, as if that answered the question. He began to rock again, and McKellis stood twisting the leash in his hand. Maybe you got some friend that I could telephone for, George. This was a forlorn hope. He was almost sure that Wilson had no friend. There was not enough of him for his wife. He was glad a little later when he noticed a change in the room, a blue quickening by the window, and realized that dawn wasn't far off. About 5 o'clock, it was blue enough outside to snap off the light. Wilson's glazed eyes turned out to the ash heaps, where small gray clouds took on fantastic shapes and scurried here and there in the faint dawn wind. I spoke to her, he muttered after a long silence. I told her she might fool me, but she couldn't fool God. I took her to the window. With an effort, he got up and walked to the rear window and leaned with his face pressed against it. And I said, God knows what you've been doing, everything you've been doing. You may fool me, but you can't fool God. Standing behind him, McKellis saw a shock that he was looking at the eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg, which had just emerged, pale and enormous from the dissolving night. God sees everything, repeated Wilson. That's an advertisement, McKellis assured him. Something made him turn away from the window and look back into the room. But Wilson stood there a long time, his face close to the window pane, nodding into the twilight. By 6 o'clock, McKellis was worn out and grateful for the sound of a car stopping outside. It was one of the watchers of the night before who had promised to come back. So he cooked breakfast for three, which he and the other man ate together. Wilson was quieter now, and McKellis went home to sleep. When he awoke 4 hours later and hurried back to the garage, Wilson was gone. His movements, he was on foot all the time, were afterward traced to Port Roosevelt and then to Gad's Hill, where he bought a sandwich that he didn't eat and a cup of coffee. He must have been tired and walking slowly, for he didn't reach Gad's Hill until noon. Thus far, there was no difficulty in accounting for his time. There were boys who had seen a man acting sort of crazy, and motorists at Homie stared oddly from the side of the road. Then for 3 hours he disappeared from view. The police, on the strength of what he said to McKellis, that he had a way of finding out, supposed that he spent that time going from garage to garage thereabout, inquiring for a yellow car. On the other hand, no garage man who had seen him ever came forward. And perhaps he had an easier, surer way of finding out what he wanted to know. By 2:30, he was in West Egg, where he asked someone the way to Gadsby's house. So by that time, he knew Gadsby's name. At 2:00, Gadsby put on his bathing suit and left word with the butler that if anyone phoned, word was to be brought to him at the pool. He stopped at the garage for a pneumatic mattress that had amused his guests during the summer, and the chauffeur helped him to pump it up. Then he gave instructions that the open car wasn't to be taken out under any circumstances. And this was strange, because the front right fender needed repair. Gadsby shouldered the mattress and started for the pool. Once he stopped and shifted it a little, the chauffeur asked him if he needed help, but he shook his head and, in a moment, disappeared among the yellowing trees. No telephone message arrived, but the butler went without his sleep and waited for it until 4:00, until long after there was anyone to give it to if it came. I have an idea that Gadsby himself didn't believe it would come, and perhaps he no longer cared. If that was true, he must have felt that he had lost the old warm world, paid a high price for living too long with a single dream. He must have looked up at an unfamiliar sky, through frightening leaves, and shivered as he found what a grotesque thing a rose is, and how raw the sunlight was upon the scarcely created grass. A new world, material without being real, where poor ghosts, breathing dreams like air, drifted fortuitously about, like that ashen, fantastic figure gliding toward him through the amorphous trees. The chauffeur, he was one of Wolsheim's protégés, heard the shots. Afterwards, he could only say that he hadn't thought anything much about them. I drove from the station directly to Gadsby's house, and my rushing anxiously up the front steps was the first thing that alarmed anyone. But they knew then, I firmly believe. With scarcely a word said, four of us, the chauffeur, butler, gardener, and I, hurried down to the pool. There was a faint, barely perceptible movement of the water as the fresh flow from one end urged its way toward the drain at the other, with little ripples that were hardly the shadows of waves. The laden mattress moved regularly down the pool. A small gust of wind that scarcely corrugated the surface was enough to disturb its accidental course with its accidental burden. The touch of a cluster of leaves revolved it slowly, tracing, like the leg of a transit, a thin red circle in the water. It was after we started with Gadsby toward the house that the gardener saw Wilson's body a little way off in the grass. And the Holocaust was complete. Thank you for joining Bite at a Time Books today, while we read a bite of one of your favorite classics. Again, my name is Bree Carlisle, and I hope you come back tomorrow for the next bite of The Great Gatsby.